We are continuing today our study through the book of Hebrews that we have been walking through chapter by chapter and verse by verse. And we continue in particular the examination that we are undergoing right now of Hebrews chapter 11, the so-called faith chapter or the faith hall of fame. We're still walking down the corridors of this great chapter. The inspired author of the book of Hebrews, perhaps the Apostle Paul, uses different tactics within the book of Hebrews to exhort wayward Jewish Christians, those who are shrinking back from the gospel, their confession of faith in Christ. We've cited a number of times the two great themes of Hebrews, one being Christology, who is Christ, secondly, an exhortation to perseverance among these backslidden Jewish Christians. And again, Paul uses different tactics. At times, he uses what we might be able to call negative tactics. That is, he warns using warnings, the warnings against apostasy. It's as if you're crucifying Christ anew. On the other hand, in addition to these negative tactics, he also uses what we could call positive tactics. And these are positive descriptions in particular of godly men of the past. And that's exactly what is being done in Hebrews 11. It is a positive, a wooing of these wayward Jewish Christians, telling them to look to the great men and women of the past and to continue to persevere in faith rather than abandoning the faith. Last time we looked at Abraham, we began to look at Abraham. And if you're in Hebrews 11 and you're reading through the account, you know that a large part of Hebrews 11 is given over to the treatment of Father Abraham. From verse 8 of Hebrews 11 all the way through to verse 19. So Abraham gets more focus and more attention than any other figure from the past, from the Old Testament, as a model or an example of faith. And we noted last time that Hebrews 11 is in some ways the Old Testament in miniature. It starts off talking about the great men of the ancient past that are described in Genesis 1 through 11, men like Enoch and like Noah. And then it turns the corner and begins to talk about Abraham and goes on to talk about some of the other patriarchs. In fact, all of the patriarchs, Isaac and Jacob, and then also Joseph. And so this part of Hebrews is focused upon the narrative material in Genesis 12 through 50. We started last time looking at Abraham, and I had noted that there were four events in the life of Abraham that the inspired author chooses to call attention to. And those four events in the life of Abraham were first, in verse 8, his call to leave his homeland. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out not knowing whither he went. So that was the first event in Abraham's life that is focused upon, that shows him to be a man of faith. Secondly, in verses 9 and 10, there's an emphasis upon Abraham sojourning in the land of promise. And then it moves on in verses 11 through 16 to focus upon the faith of Abraham and Sarah in the conception of Isaac and the averting of the threat to the promise that they would not have children. And then the fourth and final event that is surveyed in the life of Abraham is his offering up of Isaac. Perhaps there are no other scenes from the Bible that are depicted as frequently in a lot of the medieval art as that of the sacrifice of Isaac, so-called, when Abraham is called upon to place Isaac, his beloved, only begotten son Isaac, upon the altar. One of the things you just notice about this, by the way, is that Abraham is not being presented by the inspired author of Hebrews as a man with what we might call feet of clay. We know that Abraham was a man, and thereby he was a sinner. The only man who has lived without sin is the Lord Jesus Christ. So Abraham was a sinner. He fell short of God's glory. And yet, the presentation of Abraham in Hebrews 11 is not like many cynical modern portrayals of heroes from the past. It does not attempt to tear down his character, to expose his weaknesses. But he is presented nearly wholly positive as a model, again, an example to emulate. Last time we started out, I looked at the first two events from the life of Abraham and a bit of the third, but I'm going to pick up and look back at these third and fourth events, and then we're going to move forward a little bit and look as well at the life of some of the patriarchs who followed after Abraham. So we'll pick it up in verse 13, where it says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth." And the reference here is back to Abraham and Sarah, who are referred to in verse 11. Through faith, also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. So Abraham and Sarah, as we mentioned last time, in their old age, the promise had been given, Genesis 12, that they would have a seed, and from that seed a great nation would be formed. That great nation would be a blessing to the other nations. But no child came, and then eventually they were able to conceive in their old age, and this was Isaac, and this is what is focused upon. But here in verse 13 it says that they died, and it says in particular that they died in faith. It's an interesting way of putting things. On one hand, it describes a very, what we might call, depressing reality. They died. But on the other hand, it provides a surprisingly uplifting reality. They died in faith. The Greek phrase here is kata piston. Kata being a preposition, according to, piston, faith, according to faith. They died according to faith. This implies that when they died as faithful believers. And this is part of, I think, the implicit teaching that is here in this passage, particularly these wayward Jewish Christians. Aspire to be the type of person who endures, so that when you die, when you come to the end of your days, you can go to your deathbed with a clear conscience, having kept the faith. I think of what Jesus taught in Matthew 24:13 when he told his disciples, "But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved." Now, Jesus was talking about predictions of the end of the ages, prophecies of the end of the ages. But he's also talking, I think, about their endurance to the end of their course in this life, and encouraging them to keep the faith, to remain faithful unto the end. We think about the Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4, a passage that's often read in the funeral services of Christians. Here, Paul probably writing this days, perhaps hours, before he would die a martyr's death himself. And in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6 and following, Paul writes, "For I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day, and not to me only, but unto all them also that love his appearing." And the question is, when you get to the end of your days, will you be able, like Paul, to say, "I have fought a good fight. I have kept the faith. I have kept the faith once for all delivered to the saints. Or are you going to be the kind of person who, when it comes to the end of your days, you're going to essentially say, you know, I tried out Christianity for a few years, and then some things that weren't so pleasant, everything didn't exactly go my way, and so I just took it, rolled it up in a ball, and I threw it on the garbage heap. Do you want to be somebody like that, or do you want to be someone like Abraham and Sarah, like the Apostle Paul, someone who died in the faith? Verse 13, if we just dwell on it for just a few more moments, it's an interesting sentence. You can look at it in the original language. There's that one finite verb in the sentence that is died. These all died in faith. And then there are a series of five what are called participles that give further descriptions of these persons who died in the faith and describing what the realities of their life were like. The first of these is the little phrase, they were not receiving. They were not receiving the promises. Not having received the promises is the wording as it is here in our text. This says that Abraham and Sarah got Isaac, but they did not live to see a great nation come from their seed. They did not live to see Israel as a great nation state arise. They didn't live to see in the flesh King David or King Solomon. They did not see the nations be blessed through that one who came through the line of David. They did not see in the flesh while in their earthly lives the ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ. So they died not having received the promises. Secondly, though, it says in verse 13, the second of what are these five participles, it says of them, but having seen them afar off. They didn't receive them, but they saw them out in the distance, off in the distance. They believed in the reality of the fulfillment of the promises that had been made to them, though they did not readily or presently see them. I'm going to make a reference to John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress here at the end of the message, but here I might just call out by way of illustration, if you ever read through the book, they're traveling from the city of destruction, the pilgrims are, to the celestial city, and as they face different difficulties and as they come sometimes to places of rest and refreshment, they can always look off in the horizon, and there in the distance they can see the celestial city. And so our journey in this life is like that. We come through difficulties, we come through good experiences, but we can always see off in the distance the hope of eternal life in Christ. And this is what sustains us in the journey. And Abraham and Sarah were like that. They hadn't received the promises, but they saw them afar off. Furthermore, it says in the third of these five participles in verse 13, that they were persuaded of them. That is, they believed in the reality of these promises, as I've already mentioned. This means they did not die crossing their fingers. They died the way they had lived, with godly confidence. You may know the French mathematician René Pascal introduced this concept called Pascal's wager. He said it's better on just the basis of probability to be a believer, because if you're not a believer and you end up being wrong in the end result is hell. If there is no God and you say you're a believer, in the end you just pass into nothingness. But if you are a believer and there is a God, then you pass into eternal bliss. Of course, that's not the reason to be a Christian, like it's some kind of probability wager that one makes with his life. That's not the way the Christian approaches it. The Christian approaches not in ignorance, but he approaches his faith with a confidence. He is persuaded of the reality of the promises that have been given to him through Christ. The fourth participle there in verse 13, it says, they embrace them. The verb that is used here means to welcome, to greet, or to salute. They welcomed, they embraced the promises that were given to them. And then finally, the fifth and final of the participles in verse 13, describing Abraham and Sarah who died in faith, it says that they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. We looked at this a bit last week and talked about how in the general epistles, in 1 Peter and in James, believers are likewise referred to as aliens and strangers as part of the diaspora. And here, again, similar language is used. Christians are strangers. The word here in Greek is xenoi. We get the negative word xenophobic, fear of strangers. But here it says xenoi, strangers. And a word that means pilgrims, those on a journey. And this is what Christians are like. Again, we talked some about this last week. Christians are otherworldly. We are not so strongly attached to this world, though we acknowledge this world is good, lovely. God made it. Though sin has tarnished it, it's still a good place to be. It still reflects the grandeur and glory of God. But we walk through this life the way Abraham and Sarah did. We walk through it as strangers and pilgrims. If you've ever lived outside of the country, you know what it's like to live as a pilgrim. We had the experience to live a couple years in Hungary, and we loved living in Hungary. We loved the Hungarians, but it wasn't our home. We were strangers in a strange land. When you live in a foreign country, you're living in a culture that you might enjoy, but it's not your home culture. You may learn to speak the language, but it's not your mother tongue. They don't know your heroes. They don't know your athletes. They don't celebrate your holidays, your customs. They're not familiar with your literature or your jokes or your songs always. If you've ever had the experience of being outside the United States, say on something like the 4th of July, it's a very strange, surreal experience on the 4th of July when you know that everyone back in the U.S. is having a barbecue and putting their flags out and things like that, to be in a country where the 4th of July isn't Independence Day and you go through a normal work day. You may gather with friends at the end of the day, but it's literally being in a place that doesn't recognize your holy days or your holidays. Again, it's no accident that John Bunyan called his wonderful allegory, The Christian Life, the Pilgrim's Progress. The Pilgrim's Progress. The Pilgrim's advancement through this life, or his journey through this life. The inspired author adds, Hebrews 11:14, "For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country." And the word he uses here in Greek is patris. They seek a fatherland. They seek a homeland. Christians are patriotic for a home which they have never visited or seen with their eyes. And then he continues in Hebrews 11:15, "And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned." I think he's adding here a couple things. One, he's saying, don't be so attached to the country out of which you've come, the world, that you might want to stay there or return there rather than go to the heavenly city. And he may also be saying that there should be enough of the heavenly city in us that we would want to return there as our true dwelling place. Thus he says in verse 16, "But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly." Christians are in this world loving it, enjoying it, but also knowing that we're looking for a new heavens and a new earth. Just last week, a friend texted me and was asking me about the land promise that was given to Israel within the Old Testament. And he was asking me what I thought about it. I think he had probably run into some dispensationalist teaching of some sort. And he was asking me about what I thought about the land promise. And indeed, there was a land promise, as it's sometimes called, given to Father Abraham. Genesis 15:18 says, "In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, 'Unto thy seed have I given this land from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. If you are familiar with dispensationalism, many believe that that land promise only sort of begun to be fulfilled in 1948 when the modern nation state of Israel was formed. There were once again Jews in the historic land of Israel. And they look for some future event when Israel's borders are to expand, perhaps even in what they posit as the millennial period when there will be the fulfillment of this land promise. But when I texted back to my friend, I asked him to go and read Joshua chapter 21 and verses 43 and following, wherein it says, "And the Lord gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein." And what I communicate to my friend is I believe that that land promise of Genesis 15:18 was fulfilled in the conquest, in the time when the Israelites came out of bondage in Egypt and entered into the land of promise under Joshua. And it says here explicitly, the Lord fulfilled that promise. The literal land promise to Abraham was fulfilled at the time of the conquest under Joshua. But Hebrews 11, the passage we're looking at today, provides another inspired insight, which I don't think the dispensationalists always get. And that is, there was a spiritual land promise to Abraham. He was promised not just land in this earth, but he was promised a heavenly country. He was promised a heavenly land. And all those who follow in the footsteps of Abraham in the faith likewise do not seek merely an earthly land, but they seek a heavenly country. They seek a place where God, the author continues to say in verse 16, where God is not ashamed to be called their God. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? Sometimes people are apologetic about what the scriptures teach on biblical standards for things like sexuality and marriage and ethics and so forth. They're apologetic. The problem is sometimes people act as if they are ashamed of God. They don't speak boldly for God, stand for God's word. This gives us sort of the opposite thing to think about, and that is God sometimes ashamed of us? And certainly in our current state where we are not fully sanctified, God is not fully pleased with us. But when we reach that heavenly country and we reach the final stage of the journey, the last leg, when we are fully glorified by his grace in heaven, then in that place, he is not ashamed to be called our God. Look at the last line of verse 16. For he hath prepared for them a city. God has prepared a city for his people. And of course, there is something of the language of analogy here. Heaven is really more glorious than our puny, finite human minds can comprehend. But we know what cities are like. We know what places where people dwell are like. And heaven, according to the scriptures, will be a city. It will be a dwelling place for God's people. He has prepared for us not only a land, but a city in which to live. And we can compare John's great vision in Revelation 21, wherein John says in verse 1, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. And God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. And there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain. For the former things are passed away. And you might just want to take some time and read even the rest of Revelation 21 as he further describes that city. He describes it in Revelation 21, 22 as a place that has no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it because the glory of God and the Lamb are its light. He describes it in Revelation 21, 22 as being a place where there is no temple, there are no churches in heaven, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. God is present fully among his people directly. All of that sentiment that is spoken by John in Revelation 21 is here stated by the author of Hebrews. For he hath prepared for them a city. Now, again, four events in the life of Abraham that are focused on here in Hebrews 11. The third of those being the promise to Abraham and Sarah who died in faith, that they would have a child, Isaac. Through that child, the nations would be blessed. The fourth event in the life of Abraham that is noted by the inspired author is the offering up again of Isaac. And we see this in verses 17 through 19. Let me just read verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son. The background here, of course, is Genesis 22. You should read Genesis 22 to fully understand the background here. Again, it's often called the sacrifice or the offering of Isaac. And we notice here in verse 17 the repetition of that great stock phrase, by faith. By faith, Abraham. When it talks about Abraham having been then tried, when he was tried, the verb here in Greek is pyrazo, the same verb that is often rendered as tempted. When Jesus is tempted in the wilderness is the verb that is used. There are indeed temptations to do evil. Satan tempted Jesus to do wicked things like bow down and worship him. But the scriptures are very clear that God himself does not tempt men or try men to do evil. James is very clear about this in James 1:13. It says, let no man say when he is tempted or tried, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. So God does not tempt men to do evil, although in his wisdom he sometimes permits Satan and other sinful men and creatures to offer such temptations. What is being referred to here when it says in Genesis, or when it says in Genesis 22 and reiterated in Hebrews 11:17, that Abraham was tried or tempted, it's not that God tempted him to do something evil. It's that God tried or tested Abraham by giving him the opportunity to obey his command. That is, he gave him the opportunity to do that which is good and right and pleasing to God. Just think about that for a moment. We often think about temptation or being tried or tested as something purely being tested as to whether you'll do something evil or not. Sometimes we think of the world, again, as rife with dangerous temptations to do evil, and indeed it is. The devil goes about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. On the other hand, there's another way to see it, and that is this world, this life, is filled with opportunities to obey. It's filled with trials, tests, where we have the opportunity to obey God's commands and to obey his word. And this is the type of trial or test that Abraham was given of old. It's described that way in Genesis 22 and verse 1, wherein it says that God did tempt Abraham. Of course, the temptation, the trying was, as it's recorded in Genesis 22, verse 2, God said to Abraham, take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains, which I will tell thee of." I might just say here as a side comment, some skeptics say, well, it says here that Isaac was his only son, but he had another son. He had Ishmael through Hagar. And of course, the biblical writers knew that. The point is, Isaac was the only son with Sarah, the only son bearing the covenant promise. And God told him to take that only son, the one through whom the blessing would come, the one through whom the great nation would come, and to sacrifice that son. What a devastating and an even apparently cruel command this was to Abraham. I shudder to think how any of us who are parents here today, how we would respond if we lived in the period before the inscripturation of the word, when God directly spoke sometimes to men and women. How would we respond if we were asked to sacrifice one of our dear children, in particular if we had an only child? How would we respond? Of course, God will never ask someone to do something like that today, because he has spoken to us in these days through the inscripturation of his word. And so we should not think that God would ask such things of us today as he did of Abraham of old. Still, again, we think of, what is this command? Well, this command is, an opportunity for Abraham to obey God. And if you look at verse 17, Hebrews 11, 17, it says of Abraham, "And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son." Abraham obeyed God. The world idolizes rebels. The scriptures exalt those who submit and obey to God as their ultimate authority. It continues in verse 18, wherein it says, "Of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called." And this is just stressing again the fact that really the call, the command of God to sacrifice Isaac, aside from being, as I just described it, a terrible, perhaps personal decision, a father giving his son over to death. More than that, really, I think for the ancient readers, it would have been that here is a threat to the promise of God. God gave a promise in Genesis 12 that Abraham would be blessed. From his seed would come a great nation. He's too old to have another child. So the sacrifice of Isaac is not just the tragedy of him taking the life of his son, but it's also the tragedy of the failure of the promise. And that is made clear in verse 18. So again, it's the great threat to the promise. But what do we see then that happens? Does God pull the rug, as it were, from under the feet of Abraham? Maybe you feel sometimes you could relate to Abraham. You feel like God has made promises to you as a believer, but then it might appear to you at various points that those promises aren't being fulfilled. They're being threatened. The rug is being pulled out from under you. And still, despite this, Abraham persisted in obeying God. It says in Genesis 22:9 that when Abraham came to the place that God had told him, he built an altar, he put the word in order, he bound up Isaac his son, he laid him on the altar. And in verse 10 of Genesis 22, it says, "And Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son." Now, the author of Hebrews does not, going back to Hebrews 11, he doesn't proceed to describe what we perhaps are most struck by in the narrative in Genesis 22. He doesn't describe how God sent the angel to stay Abraham's hand, or how that Abraham found a ram who was caught in the thicket, and how that ram became a substitute. And the author of Hebrews, the inspired author, doesn't do some of the things we might be inclined to want to do with this account. We might want to talk about Jesus as the substitute. about his substitutionary atonement, his death on the cross in the place of sinners. That's not, though, where the author goes in Hebrews 11. Instead, we are provided with a unique insight that is found nowhere else in the Scriptures. Abraham, according to Hebrews 11, was willing to obey God's command to sacrifice Isaac because he believed that God, even if he took the life of Isaac, that God would raise Isaac from the dead. He believed in the sovereign power of God. He believed that God alone had the power over life and death. Therefore, he was willing to obey the command of God. And this is made clear in verse 19. It says that Abraham accounting, figuring that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. That's why Abraham was able to obey God's command, because he trusted even in God's ability, even if he took the life of Isaac, he trusted in God's ability even to raise him from the dead. Just think about that for a moment. Think how this would have been read by those first Jewish Christians who were backslidden. Think how this unique insight might have registered with them. Think what it would be like if you were a backslidden Jewish Christian who had in part turned your back upon Christ, perhaps because you were afraid for your life. Maybe you were afraid of threats against you. And I think what he's saying to them is, listen, God is in charge. Even if you're threatened with the loss of your life, as Isaac was, like Abraham, you should trust in the power of God. As Jesus himself taught in Matthew 10:28, he told his disciples, don't fear those who kill the body, but fear rather him who is able to kill the soul and to cast both the soul and the body into hell. That is the one whom we should fear. We should fear the Lord because he is sovereign. He has the power of life and death. He has the power not only and the sovereignty over the first death, but even over spiritual death, the second death. And so we should fear him and honor him. After reviewing now these four events in the life of Abraham, we see the inspired author moving on to the other patriarchs. I'm just going to touch briefly upon these because the inspired author likewise just touches very briefly upon them. In verse 20, he says of Isaac, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Here the background is Genesis 27, the blessings that were given first to Jacob. If you're in Genesis 27 and verses 28 and 29, it says that Jacob blessed, Jacob was blessed by Isaac. As Isaac said, therefore God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee and blessed be he that blesseth thee. And that's an echo, isn't it, of the blessing that was given to Abraham in Genesis 12. There's also a blessing given to Esau. And then in verse 21, he moves on to Jacob, the next of the patriarchs. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. And this refers to the scene that is described in Genesis 48, when the aged Jacob is called upon by Joseph to bless his sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. He famously crosses his hands and blesses the younger above that of the older. And he says there, as it's recorded in Genesis 48, verse 15, and he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed me all my life long unto this day, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads and let my name be named on them and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And what he's saying is that there's the continuation of this, not only the promise, but the hope in the fulfillment of the promise expressed by the great patriarchs here by Jacob. And then the last verse we'll look at today, verse 22, he moves on to Joseph, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, from whom came the tribes of Israel. And it says of Joseph, verse 22, by faith Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. And the reference here is to the very end of Genesis, in Genesis 50. The final three verses describe how Joseph said to his brethren that he was going to die. But he also prophesies, verse 24 of Genesis 50, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he sware to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And so we have Joseph, again, referring to the promise made to Abraham, trusting in its fulfillment, though he did not see it within his own life. The point, the repeated point, is that these men died in faith. They died not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and being persuaded of them and having embraced them, they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims. We see verse 13 applied to all the patriarchs. We've worked through the passage, and let me turn and draw some application. I'm interested how this passage focuses upon the death of these great men, how they died, but they died in the faith. It says that of Abraham and Sarah, says that at the very end about Joseph. Hebrews was written to encourage Jewish Christians not to abandon Christ. Again, that's one of the two major purposes. One, to tell us about Christ. Secondly, to encourage or exhort to faithfulness, perseverance. Don't abandon Christ. If these persons, if these Jewish Christians have been truly converted, if they're truly regenerate, if they truly know saving faith, the inspired author is saying they will be granted enduring faith. If they know saving faith, they will be given enduring faith. Their perseverance in the faith, what is more, in the end, does not depend upon their faithfulness. But whose faithfulness does it depend on? It depends on the Lord's faithfulness to them. And so, again, the great weight of this passage, the positive exhortation, is be like the great men and women of old. Don't give up. Continue to persevere. This is a sign, in fact, that you are really His. And if you're going to endure, it's not going to be because of your faithfulness. It's going to be because of God's faithfulness to you. If you ever read Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, and again, I said I was going to make reference to this here in our application. If you ever read through it, in the second part of the book, there's a scene in which the pilgrims are passing through a place called the Valley of Humiliation. It's described as a valley that nobody walks in but those that love a pilgrim's life. And one of the pilgrims is named Honest. And he's talking to the man who is the guide for Christiana, Christian's wife. He's guiding her and her children to the celestial city. And this great heart, in many ways, is an allegory for a pastor. And anyway, Honest and Great Heart begin discussing and talking together. And they start talking about a previous pilgrim, a man who's already made the journey. His name was Mr. Fearing. And Honest says of Mr. Fearing, he says, oh, I knew him well. And he affirms that Mr. Fearing had the root of the matter, meaning he seemed to have been really converted. He really seemed to understand the Christian faith. But he says he was one of the most troublesome pilgrims that ever I met with in all my days. And then Greatheart responds and says, yes, I knew of his weaknesses, but he says, I could very well bear it, for men of my calling are oftentimes entrusted with the conduct of such as he was. And then Greatheart goes on and describes to Honest and the other pilgrims how he guided Mr. Fearing on the pilgrimage to the celestial city. And he describes how at various points along the way, It seemed that Mr. Fearing's fears would overwhelm him and that he would not complete the journey. But at each point, somehow he's able to make it through. Somehow he's able to just barely to make it through. And in particular, he describes this man as being one who was fearful that he wouldn't be able to complete the journey. And this, how this nearly paralyzed him. He says, why he was always afraid that he should come up short of whither he had desire to go. He also says of him that he had a slough of despond, or a swamp, in his mind. A slough that he carried everywhere with him. In the end, though, Greatheart describes how he eventually led Mr. Fearing to the final river. Of course, if you read the book, the last hazard on the journey is they had to pass over a river to get the Celestial City. And the river obviously represents death. Even Christian in part one has a difficult time when he crosses the river, can't touch bottom, and he becomes very anxious and fearful, but eventually gets over. And Greatheart surely was wondering whether someone as timid and fearful as Mr. Fearing, whether he would be able to get across the river safely. But he says when they arrived there, Greatheart says he noticed what was, he calls, very remarkable. And then he says the water of that river was lower at this time than ever I saw it in all my life. So that even Mr. Fearing then was able to pass over, as Greatheart says, not much above wet shod, and enter the city. And the point is that God, knowing Mr. Fearing's weak faith, God had allowed the river to be at its lowest point so that Mr. Fearing could safely get over into the Celestial City. I've told you a couple times in this series that I've been reading the great Presbyterian minister J. Gresham Machen's book from the 1920s titled What is Faith? And he ends his book, that great book on faith, with a reference to Bunyan's Mr. Fearing. And then the final words, the last words of Machen's book are these. He says, such is the blessed end of the man of little faith. Weak faith will not remove mountains, but there is one thing that it will do. It will bring a sinner to peace with God. Our salvation does not depend on the strength of our faith, Machen continues. Saving faith is a channel, not a force. If you are really committed to Christ, then despite your subsequent doubts and fears, you are His forever. Hebrews 11, I might say, as we sum up this message now, Hebrews 11 is a message to all the Mr. Fearings out there. Trust in the Lord who saved you, will give you the enduring faith that you need to complete the journey. To God be the glory, and may His word be blessed today.